please be seated.
The court would like to welcome students from NSU Business Law class and also the introduction to criminal justice. And if I failed to, also welcome students from Oaks High School. It's great to see high schools from other states come down and view our proceedings. The final case for oral argument this morning is Roger Lee Cahiga. Is that correct, counsel?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Appellant versus State of South Dakota, Appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Thomas Cogley, an attorney from Aberdeen. And for the Appellee, State of South Dakota, we have Ms. Ann Meyer, an Assistant Attorney General. Mr. Cogley, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel, Your Honors, my name is Tom Cogley, and I represented Roger Cahiga during the trial in this matter, and I continue to represent him on this appeal. I know I raised a number of issues in my brief. What I thought I would do with my time today is touch on some of what I believe are the more significant issues, understanding, of course, that Your Honors will dictate what it is that we talk about over the next hour or so. The first thing that I wanted to address is what I would call the confrontational clause issue that arose when Detective Neal was allowed to testify that he corroborated statements made by Mike Washington with Greg Tuharts in a subsequent interview. And I think it's important just to provide some background for everyone as to how this comes about. The Aberdeen Police Department is looking for Greg Tuharts because he's a suspect in a completely separate robbery, the Superstop robbery. I alluded to that in my brief. They have him on tape allegedly committing this crime. Ultimately, they find out that he's located himself in a hotel here in Aberdeen. He's got a gun and he's got methamphetamines and he's refusing to come out, and so this standoff ensues. Thanks to some wonderful work by Detective Chris Gross of the Aberdeen Police Department, he eventually surrenders and they have a conversation. And during that conversation, Greg Tuharts doesn't talk about the Superstop robbery. He talks about this Casino Corner robbery, which is the subject of this appeal. He implicates Roger, my client, and he also implicates Michael Washington, although not by name. He provides a description, and he says that these are the two men that are that participated in that Casino Corner robbery. Law enforcement ends that interview. They go and get a search warrant for the Superstop robbery, and when they execute on that search warrant at a residence here in Aberdeen, lo and behold, they locate Roger Cahiga and Mike Washington. Roger doesn't say anything to them. Mike Washington, though, does give a statement. And he implicates himself and Roger, but he also implicates Greg Tuharts, which is new information for the Aberdeen Police Department. Detective Neal goes and he interviews Greg Tuharts at the South Dakota Penitentiary, he's been taken back there on a parole violation. And he talks to him about the conversation that he had with Mike Washington. We fast forward 5 months to trial. Washington testifies, he says what he says, and then Greg Tuharts takes the stand. And he doesn't say anything. He just refuses to even acknowledge his name. Ultimately, the trial court holds him in contempt, throws him off the stand, and he's now an unavailable witness. Detective Neal then comes and testifies. And during my cross-examination with Detective Neal, I begin to question him about things that he could have done or should have done to follow up on Mike's story. The state comes back on redirect, and they rightly want to rehabilitate Detective Neal. And so they begin to ask him about specific statements that Greg Tuharts made during that second interview at the penitentiary. I object, the jury's excused, and that's when we have this conversation with respect to the Sixth Amendment and Crawford versus Washington. And ultimately, the trial court agrees with me with respect to the fact that it says that Crawford and the Sixth Amendment don't allow for you to ask specific statements made by Greg Tuharts because he's an unavailable witness. However, it does allow, and this is one of the reasons that we're here today, it does allow them to ask a different question. It allows them to ask about corroborating Mike's testimony with Greg Tuharts. And that, Your Honors, is what I believe is the Confrontation Clause issue. And I think when we look at the Sixth Amendment and we look at Crawford and specifically some of the things that the court, the U.S. Supreme Court, said in Crawford, and we keep those things in mind as we're looking at what happened here, I think it's clear that a violation took place. The Sixth Amendment allows a criminal defendant like Roger the right to confront witnesses, to challenge the state's evidence. And in Crawford, the Supreme Court said that that the text of the Sixth Amendment does not suggest open-ended exceptions for trial courts to develop tests. And it says that it's not the job of trial courts to extrapolate from the text specific rules based on the values that it believes is behind the Confrontation Clause. And it's for that reason that the U.S. Supreme Court, in a subsequent decision, Bullcoming versus New Mexico, held that it did violate the Confrontation Clause when a prosecutor attempted to introduce a forensic lab report through the in-court testimony of a lab technician who didn't observe the test when it was conducted and who didn't sign the certification related to the test. The court held that that was a violation of the Confrontation Clause and that the prosecutor in that case basically circumvented Crawford or circumvented the Sixth Amendment. And I think that's what the state was allowed to do in this case. When it was allowed to ask allowed to ask Detective Neal about corroborating Greg Tuhart's, corroborating Mike Washington's testimony or statement with Greg Tuhart's, it ran afoul of the Confrontation Clause because I don't have any right or any ability to cross-examine him because he's an unavailable witness.
Are you faulting the state for not doing a necessary step in this process, or are you simply saying that under these circumstances that information was not going to come in?
I'm not faulting the state for anything. I just think for anything. I don't think that the statements could come in. Let's keep in mind what the state's trying to do. They're trying to rehabilitate Greg Tuhart's, and there's a way to do this that doesn't involve Confrontation Clause implications. And here's how you do it. Detective Neal, did you follow up on Mike Washington's statements? Yes. Did you go to the penitentiary? Yes. Did you talk to Greg Tuhart's? Yes. The fourth question you could have asked, and maybe this is a little bit iffier, but did you talk to Greg Tuhart's about what Mike Washington told you? Yes. I don't like that line of questioning because it doesn't help me and it doesn't help my client, but I don't think I have a Confrontation Clause issue. But when you ask the corroboration question, and this is the question that was asked, Detective Neal, did you, after talking to Mike Washington on March 26th, did you corroborate some of Mike's admissions about the robbery with Greg Tuhart's? Answer, yes, I did.
How was your client prejudiced by that?
Thank you, Your Honor. My client was prejudiced because the case against Roger consisted primarily of Mike Washington's statements. And the law, South Dakota law is clear, the statute is clear, the case law is clear, and the jury instructions that were provided are clear that you can't convict Roger Cahiga based on Mike Washington's statement unless you can corroborate that with some other evidence. And the jury was required and instructed to remove Washington's testimony and then consider what evidence remains. And the evidence that remains doesn't connect Roger to the crime, but when you allow the state to ask that corroboration question of Detective Neal, now Roger's being prejudiced because the jury believes that it's been corroborated.
If you do not succeed on your argument on corroboration, do you still have a valid claim here for prejudice on the Confrontation Clause?
Yes, Your Honor, because if we look at the Confrontation Clause analysis and what the Supreme Courts have told us to do, we've got to first look at was the evidence that was presented, even under a harmless error review, was the evidence that was presented cumulative? And there's nobody else saying that Greg Tuhart's and Mike Washington gave the same story. And we don't know whether they did or they didn't, but for purposes of your question, nobody else is saying that. The next thing that we look at is there any evidence which either corroborates or contradicts this evidence? And honestly, Your Honors, I don't know how to answer that for you. There's facts on both sides. Perhaps it's a nullity. But the last one also weighs in favor of our argument, which is that the overall strength of the prosecution's case. And my response to that one, and the reason that I think it falls on our side of the coin, is the same reason that I told the jury. If the prosecution's case in this instance was so strong, how does Mike Washington end up with the deal that he does? How does he get, to use Detective Neal's own words, the best deal that Detective Neal has ever seen anyone get? And so, yes, the independent of the cooperation issue, which I also think was a mistake, there's still a confrontation clause issue, and it was prejudicial, even under a harmless error standard of review. We also have to keep in mind the context of the way all of this stuff comes out, and the rehabilitation, and the fact that the state had other avenues to pursue. There are other ways to get this evidence in. There's other ways to fix Detective Neal's testimony or rehabilitate it, not that it needed fixing necessarily. But what they did not only runs afoul of the Confrontation Clause, it also runs afoul of our state law, which is what I was alluding to earlier. You cannot cooperate one accomplice with another accomplice. And the jury was instructed on that point, and I think it was jury instruction 15 or 16, when it talks about what you have to look at to corroborate Mike Washington's statement. And it was instructed that you can't look at another accomplice. And that's why I asked the trial court during the jury settlement instructions to rule that Greg Tuharts was also an accomplice as a matter of law. And I was denied that opportunity, and so you've compounded the error. In addition to the Confrontation Clause issue, now you've got the jury being instructed that it has to find corroborating evidence, and that corroborating evidence can't come from an accomplice, but Greg Tuharts is clearly an accomplice, and the jury's not told that. And so you've got that issue as well. The other thing that I wanted to talk about with respect to Detective Neal was the rebuttal evidence that was let in. And again, to provide some background for those who may not know, after we rested, the state then recalled Detective Neal to testify about a conversation between Roger and his wife in which they're discussing the existence or whether the police have surveillance video of Roger and Greg and Mike together in North Dakota a few hours after the robbery. The trial court ruled that that was proper rebuttal evidence, and it wasn't. And it was, again, even under an abuse of discretion standard, it was against the reason and the evidence of the that was presented, and here's why. Your honors have said in, I think it was Schrader versus Jarks, that rebuttal evidence is evidence that explains, contradicts, or refutes the defendant's evidence. And so we have to look at what we put on. We never attempted during our case in chief to show that Roger and Mike were not together that day. We never attempted to show that Roger didn't go to a casino in North Dakota.
So where's the prejudice?
The prejudice, Your Honor, it goes to the fact, what I alluded to earlier with respect to Michael Washington being the main key to this case. And so the state is rested, and we put on evidence about where Roger is at 4:30 or 4:45. His friend Deontay testifies that he's at Roger's apartment, his girlfriend's there, his children are there. Roger's there with his family. They hang out for a while. Deontay leaves with his family at about 4:30 or 4:45. We also know from the evidence at trial that it's about a four-hour drive from Aberdeen to Cokato, Cokato to Aberdeen. I suppose it's the same both ways. But it's 4 hours away. And this robbery occurs at 8:30 in January. And so we don't attempt to show what happens to Roger after 4:30 or 4:45. We don't have his wife testify that they were together that evening watching TV. We don't have his friends come over and say, well, we went and played basketball until midnight. If we had done that, this is absolutely proper rebuttal. But no, and I'm getting to your answer in a moment here, Chief Justice. I apologize, it's taken me a long time. The evidence that we put on, no one has ever explained to me how the rebuttal evidence explains, contradicts, or refutes where Roger was at 4:30 or 4:45. The fact that he may have been in North Dakota at 11:30, hours after the robbery, we never attempted to challenge that or show that that wasn't the case. If we had, again, it would have been proper rebuttal, and it probably would have been proper for the state to bring it during its case in chief as part of rehabilitating Detective Neal, but they didn't do that.
But it casts doubt on the implication of the evidence that you offered.
Say that again,
It casts. The state's point was that its evidence casts doubt on the implication that you raised by placing your client in Cato.
I don't believe that it does, and that's, you know, one of the things that the state does in its brief, it sets up a bit of a straw man argument, which I think goes to your point, that our evidence was intended to show that Roger was in Cocato from the during the time of the robbery and the escape. We didn't show that. We didn't provide any explanation for where he was. And when we were talking about this during the last day of trial, there was discussion about removing the alibi jury instruction. And I said, Judge, if you want to remove the alibi instruction, that's just fine with me. But I'm still going to argue that at 4:30 or 4:45, Roger was 4 hours away, and it would have been darn difficult for him to drive 4 hours and commit a robbery at 4:30. It doesn't cast doubt on the evidence that we put on, because we didn't put on any evidence about what he was doing from 4:30 or 4:45 forward. What it does is it bolsters the state's case, and it gives them another opportunity to corroborate Mike Washington's testimony after they've rested. And that's the prejudice that resulted from that decision by the trial court, is it gave the state another opportunity to let the jury say, oh, look, there is something there that perhaps ties together Mike Washington's testimony. And if they'd have done it during direct examination, I don't have that argument. I might have some of the other arguments that I raised in my brief, but I certainly can't make a rebuttal argument at that point. The other thing that I wanted to talk about was the motion for a judgment of acquittal that I made. And I believe that the judge was wrong not to grant that motion, because I don't believe that the state proved its case beyond a reasonable doubt. And the reason for that is, as what I alluded to earlier with respect to Mike Washington and his testimony, the jury was told that what you have to do in this case, and this is from the pattern jury instructions, is you have to remove Mike Washington's testimony from this case, and then you have to look at all of the evidence that remains, and you have to decide if any of it connects Roger to the crime. It can't simply show that a crime was committed. It has to connect him to the crime, and that's the key. And I brought this up during my closing argument, and when the prosecutor came back up, Mr. White referenced the audio tapes and the 24 audio clips of Roger and talking to his wife. What I would submit is that if you remove Mike Washington's testimony from this case, and you listen to those audio clips, even in the light most favorable to the jury's verdict, which I understand we're supposed to do, but if you do that, the best thing that you can come up with is that Roger may have participated in some criminal activity. But he never says anything that connects him to this robbery. He doesn't, and that's the standard that was supposed to be used, and that's what the jury was instructed on. When we look at some of the other evidence, the surveillance video that was presented to the jury, that doesn't connect Roger to the crime. The photos of the crime scene does not connect Roger to the crime. The shell casings that the jury was provided, those don't connect Roger to the crime. Those go to the other thing that I talk about, which is that, yes, a crime was committed. But again, the jury instruction didn't tell them that they needed to find that a crime was committed. They needed to find some evidence that connected Roger to the crime. And those things don't do it. The Mystic Lake receipt was also talked about. That's the receipt from a stay at Mystic Lake Casino in Minnesota. That doesn't even show the commission of a crime. And so it certainly doesn't connect Roger to this crime. The tear that was in Greg Tuhart's headrest, again, doesn't show the commission of a crime, and it certainly doesn't show Roger's connection to the crime. The bottom line is that there was insufficient evidence to corroborate Mike Washington's testimony. His testimony was to be viewed with distrust, and the jury had to find corroborating evidence. It was instructed on how to do that, and we don't have to argue about how easy it is for a jury to remove his testimony from the case. We all know that it's difficult, but that's what they're supposed to do. And in this case, when you remove that testimony, there simply isn't anything there to connect Roger to the crime. And for that reason, my motion for a judgment of acquittal ought to have been granted.
2 minutes, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. The last thing that I wanted to talk about before I moved into sentencing, and perhaps if Your Honors want to talk about sentencing, we can do that during rebuttal. Your Honors may not believe that any one of the errors that I talked about today or any of the errors that were mentioned in my brief warrant reversal on their own or warrant a new trial on their own. But the cumulative effect of those errors, or the aggravated effect of those errors, can result in a new trial. And Your Honors have held that in State versus Davey and in other cases. And we believe that any one of those errors, particularly the ones I talked about there today, warrant a new trial. But you don't have to agree with me. But you can agree with me that all of the errors taken together do warrant and require a new trial, and that's what we would be asking for. With the limited time that's remaining, I think I will just stop now and again address sentencing when I come back on in rebuttal, unless there are specific questions.
I guess not, so thank you, Mr. Coghlan.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Ms. Meyer, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court. Can't show commission of the crime. I'm going to start with the motion for judgment of acquittal. The state does not have to show that each one of those little tendrils of evidence can't show commission of the crime. What the jury instruction said is that the jury is to assume that the testimony of Washington is removed, but we don't have to have stand-alone evidence of what happened in this case. Every one of those threads pulled together of what the state was putting on as far as its case. And we have the testimony by Washington, who is the accomplice of the defendant. We have, he tells in detail what happened that night. The defendant ran forward and got the money, waving his gun around from the clerk. There's two other customers in that casino, and I'm talking about the Aberdeen casino because we have quite a few of them in this case. And what happens with Washington? He says, I stayed in the back. I grabbed a wallet. I grabbed a $100 bill from some of the other customers. And then they ran out the back door, and Mike doesn't even know where they went, somewhere in North Dakota, and then they went over to Mystic Lake. So what else do we have? We have Detective Neal's explanation about investigating this case. And he has some significant items. He's got photographs of the ceiling of the casino. We may not have the actual guns, but we have a slug that was in the roof. We have two shell casings. What a coincidence. They just happened to match the caliber of the guns that both Washington and the defendant were using, according to Washington's account, during the robbery. So we have these tendrils that you pulled together. We don't have to have standalone evidence that doesn't show commission of the crime. It's an entire picture. It's a totality of the evidence. And for that reason, the trial court, we also have, I don't want to forget this, we have the customers who told almost the same story that Mike told, and we have the 24 audio clips of the jail telephone conversations of the defendant with his wife. In those audio tapes, he says a lot of threats to Mike. He says, silence is our weapon. When you have someone who's trying to conceal a crime, it's consciousness of guilt. And the jury was instructed on that. So all those threads pulled together show that we had sufficient evidence in this case. And I want to move to the second issue.
Before you move on, if you remove the accomplice's testimony, ignore that totally, what evidence do you have that connects the defendant in this case to the crime?
We have his own statements, more than Zakaria. Zakaria had two. We've got 22 more statements. All of those segments of those audio tapes, he says things that if you weren't involved in the crime, you wouldn't have the proximity or know what was going on. Silence is our weapon. Tell Mike to shut up. I'm going to knock his voice box out. The cops are running in circles. We have that evidence. We have, and then if you add that together with the stories of the customers, the officer went out and tried to find one of the cell phones to see if they could locate where the cell phone evidence was. They got a ping north of Aberdeen. They found an empty spot in the headrest of Tuhart's car. You have to put the whole picture together. That's what the standard is when we have evidence from these different accomplices. You have to look at the entire picture. And that's what the state is saying, and that's why the court denied the motion for judgment of acquittal. You don't look satisfied. Am I confusing you?
Shirley, I'm showing 2 minutes on the lights.
She has 16 minutes.
16? Okay, we had a little malfunction here. You have 16 minutes left. Okay,
well,
sorry to interrupt.
I never stop talking anyway, so.
You describe evidence, but I'm not sure any of them actually tie this individual to that crime.
We don't have a perfect case. We don't have the pillow case or the money like Zakaria. But what we do have is enough to put the story together. The jury is the one who decides whether to believe the state's evidence, and they chose to believe the state's evidence. It's a jury call on whether accomplice testimony is sufficient to convict, and this jury found that it was. Now, granted, you look at this de novo, but if you pull everything together, and you can't just look at it in isolated bits, we've got the whole story, and that's the best that the officers were able to put together, because a lot of the evidence had been thrown out the window, or it wasn't, they weren't able to locate it. So we went forward with what we had. And I think particularly the jail telephone conversations get us over the hump, because it does show that he had proximity to the crime, and he knows to cover up the crime. So if there are no further questions on evidence, I'll move to the confrontation clause. Analytically, it's really hard for the state to unring the bell. When the defense opens up the cross-examination of an officer and says, only two people identified the defendant in Washington, or identified my client in this case. Did you talk to anybody else in Aberdeen after the 15th of January about Mike's statements? Corroborate Mike's statements? The door was open. The court carefully looked at that in the in-chambers hearing. He said, you opened the door. The state has a right to come back and rehabilitate Officer Neal. And we can't take those statements back. And he said, I don't think this rises to the level or jumps to the level of accomplice, one accomplice talking about another accomplice's testimony. And I'm going to let it in. He said, I don't see a confrontation clause violation. No testimonial evidence came in. The state was restricted. No words, no conversation was revealed when the detective went to the prison to talk to Two Hearts. It was simply the fact that the officer was going through the steps of his investigation, and the elephant in the room was Two Hearts. Why didn't anybody talk to Two Hearts? We had to clean that up, and that's what the state did. The defense can't have their cake and eat it too. They can't restrict the state's case. Now, if that isn't enough, when you look at the Zakaria case, it says that Crawford did not take out harmless error. It still survives. So we're saying on the basis of that, we have the other threads of what happened here. The jury could connect the dots that we would still get over the harmless error part of not having a Crawford violation. Then I'm going to move to the rebuttal evidence in terms of the alibi. And what the court looked at in terms of the alibi evidence was similar to what happened in terms of opening the door in the confrontation context. Because the defense put on this good friend of the defendant to say that the defendant was in Cokato, Minnesota, right up until 4:45 on the night of the crime, the state was allowed to rehabilitate that to show that there are parts of Washington's testimony that fit together in the puzzle. And that was the fact that we have this one, and I probably made a mistake in my brief, I said 24 segments, but we do have one more audio tape clip between the defendant and his wife at jail, which talks about a videotape in North Dakota. And the court let that in as an adoptive admission. We've argued in our brief in the alternative that it would be a statement of against interest. And in that statement, the defendant's wife says, do they really have a videotape of all of you at this casino in North Dakota, which is 2 hours after the robbery. But it still shows the story, and that what Mike was saying, Mike Washington was saying, on this, as far as what he testified to, fits together. And that's why the state was allowed to rehabilitate with the fact that this videotape or this audio tape was out there. I'm not sure what the defense is going to say on sentencing. Just as a preemptive strike, we're just going to say that the sentence in this case was appropriate because the defendant was the ringleader. Mike didn't even know where they were going when they went up to North Dakota. He's just following along, and the defendant had an extensive criminal history. which made a difference. Generally, co-defendants do receive the same, or maybe should receive the same sentence, but we still are not a one-size-fits-all sentencing state. We look at the individual characteristics of each defendant. Are there any other questions? And I'll conclude our remarks.
Okay, I guess not.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mayor. Mr. Cogley, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal, sir.
Before I delve into the sentencing, I do want to address a couple of the things that was brought out by Ms. Meyer. And I think, Justice Severson, you were sort of hitting on the point that I've been trying to make since this trial ended, basically, and that is all of this other evidence is meaningless unless you can supply Mike Washington's testimony, and that's not what we're supposed to do. You're putting the cart before the horse when you talk about that other customers in this casino talked about being shoved down or had their wallet stolen. When you're talking about the photos of the holes in the ceiling, those things don't show that Roger was connected to the crime until you then bring back in Mike Washington's testimony. And the rule that was stated to the jury is that you've got to remove it, find something that connects him, and it doesn't have to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, I understand that, but it does have to connect him in some way. And all of the other bits and pieces of evidence don't connect Roger to the crime unless you bring in Washington's testimony. And you're doing it backwards if you look at it that way. The audio clips don't, Ms. Meyer alluded to what a lot of them say. In none of those audio clips does he admit to participating in this crime. He talks about being angry. He talks about, as I conceded during my opening argument, he talks about things that may have indicated that he participated in criminal activity, but they don't connect him to this crime. Mike ties it all together. And you can't put the cart before the horse. And when we talk about the fact that the state or the law enforcement couldn't do things because evidence had been thrown out the window, that's not what came out. I went through it at great length with Detective Neal about things that he could have done. He didn't even attempt to go locate any of those other items. He didn't even attempt to contact Mystic Lake and say, hey, did these guys leave anything in their room that might have tied Roger to this crime? He didn't travel that route to North Dakota to see if there was anything on the side of the road. It's not that they couldn't find it, it's that they didn't attempt to find it. And that's the distinguishing thing. What happened with respect to Greg Tuharts, frankly, I think is the best case scenario for the state, in this case and in any other case. Because Greg Tuharts, frankly, would have made an awful witness for the state. And I am far from the greatest lawyer that God ever created, but I happen to agree with Justice White in California versus Green that when he wrote that cross-examination is the greatest legal engine ever invented for the discovery of truth. What that means is even a dumb lawyer like me can look at a guy like Greg Tuharts and cross-examine him about the stuff that I've already mentioned, cross-examine him about his prior conviction, cross-examine him about the fact that he's facing life in prison for these two things, and draw out impeachment evidence and possibly even draw out exculpatory evidence. But I'm not being allowed to do that, and the state gets the best case scenario because this officer just gets to bring in everything that they would have brought in through Greg Tuharts, and I don't have an ability to use any impeachment tools to deal with that. With respect to the sentencing, whether you look at it under an Eighth Amendment de novo analysis or whether you look at it under an abuse of discretion standard, I think that when Roger Kahiga is sentenced 8 times more severely than Mike Washington, there's a problem. And I understand from the Rice decision that Your Honor's moved away from looking at co-defendants with respect to an Eighth Amendment analysis. But you also said, Chief Justice, that some of those concepts from Bonner remain important, and you said that generally speaking, relevant to this case, similarly situated defendants should receive similar sentences. And the underlying premise in this case, and Ms. Meyer talked about it, is that Roger was the mastermind, and that his poor nephew, Mike, just went along for the ride because he felt pressured or coerced. There's nothing in the record to support that, Your Honors. Mike Washington never testified that he was pressured or coerced by Roger Kahiga to do this. He acted on his own. He fired his weapon of his own accord, not at Roger's direction. He shoved that man to the ground. He stole the man's wallet and the man's cell phone. He did those things on his own, not because Roger was pressuring him. And so when you have a sentence based on those factors that's 8 times more severe, you have to look at it and wonder what happened. And I agree, Roger does have a more significant criminal history than Mike Washington. But Mike is no saint either. He's got a prior felony conviction. Roger also pled guilty to witness tampering in connection to this case. But keep in mind, I didn't appeal that on my brief because he was punished separately for it. It's consecutive to whatever happens on the robbery. And so I don't even talk about it because it doesn't have anything to do with the robbery sentence. And Mike Washington will be eligible for parole in approximately 3 years. Roger's going to be serving 38 years. After parole, he'll be eligible for parole at about the time he's 32 or 33. And that is a disparity in the sentences. And even if we look at it under the light of chips and rice and everything like that, just looking at the disproportionality, you can see that there's a problem here. And the question becomes the severity of the offense versus the punishment, and certainly this is a violent offense. But 38 years, particularly when we look at, and what the judge took judicial notice of the average sentence in Brown County being 10 years, he's even 3 times larger than that. We put on a great deal of evidence during sentencing to show that Roger was a much more complicated individual than just a guy who allegedly committed a robbery. We had people talk about what a good father he was. We had people talk about him teaching his nephew to ride a bike, to learn how to swim. His sister-in-law talked about the things that he did for her daughter to help her come out of her shell. There was all this testimony about him giving food, clothing, shelter, money to individuals without being asked and without any expectation of repayment. The letter from the former NBA player about the things that Roger did for his foundation and calling Roger a role model, those are real things, and they're personal to Roger, and they mean something. The trial court, during sentencing, ignored all of that, and we know that because one of the first things that he said when he had an opportunity to sentence Roger was, "What you and Mike Washington did causes me to shudder." And I believe that he's being truthful when he says that. But why is Mike Washington receiving a sentence that's going to allow him to be out in a couple of years, and Roger Kahiga receiving a sentence that's going to allow him to be out when he's in his 70s? It just doesn't make any sense. And even if we look at it under an abuse of discretion standard, there's a problem. And we should at least be allowed an opportunity to go back and have a resentencing in light of the evidence that we actually put on during sentencing, evidence that was, frankly, unrefuted. What we're looking for here today, Your Honors, first of all, is that our motion for a judgment of acquittal be granted, that you reverse the decision of the trial court because there was insufficient evidence to sustain the conviction. Beyond that, we're looking at least for a new trial for any one of, or the aggregate of the offenses, the aggregate of the errors that were made by the trial court. We think we're at least entitled to that. And the third thing, if those two options fail, we're at least looking for a resentencing that takes into account the evidence that we put forth. And if the court doesn't have any other questions, I thank you for listening. And on behalf of all of the attorneys in Aberdeen, I think I was the only one with the privilege to argue this term. And so I appreciate you folks coming to Northern State. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Cogley. This does then complete our oral portion of our October term here at Northern, the 9 oral arguments. This type of a week-long event doesn't just happen by whim. It takes thorough planning and preparation that goes on throughout the year. And this court would like to thank President Downs, Provost Lefebvre, and the faculty of Northern for being such gracious hosts. You've probably observed, too, that we are provided with security, and that is by the local Highway Patrol under Captain Winemaster, the Brown County Sheriff's Office, and the Aberdeen Police Department. And we would also like to thank our staff who work long and hard to make this event a success. With that, we are in recess.